Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio here in Ames, Iowa. Well, we'll start with a little bit of a news item here. Anytime something has to do with farming or food in the newspaper or on the news nets that I look at, well, I just sort of have to read them. And Iowa had a visitor. Well, yes, they did last week. The Chinese ambassador came and visited he was on a three-state tour through the Midwest to learn about U.S. agriculture, and the Chinese ambassador drove a tractor here in Ames and tasted some good Iowa food. The ambassador, Qing Geng, stopped at a Story County farm near Maxwell, and he kind of looked over the soybeans, and he rode a tractor, and he talked to people. That was good.
Well, he didn't see much in the ground right now, did he?
No. And he had some beef and some deviled eggs, although the host family referred to them as stuffed eggs, not deviled eggs. We didn't want to cause any problems there. And probably he was here because China is the largest soy consumer in the world. So they kind of check out what we have going on here in Iowa. And this is not the first time. It seems that our connections to China go back a ways. Well, for one thing, the past governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, for a while was our ambassador to China. Huh? And in 2012, while he was still vice president, President Xi Jinping went on this same tour and drove tractors and all that sort of thing. And now, I don't know, they're not cooks, they're not farmers, but farming is
big business.
So why China's interest in our agriculture? I don't think the ambassador came all this way just to drive a tractor, but, well, we have a guest with us today that I think can help us understand the business of agribusiness and how we feed ourselves. Joining us at our kitchen table today is Timothy Wise. His new book is called Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farms, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Welcome, Timothy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good.
Tim, we have to tout some of your credentials. Tim is a senior advisor for the Institute for Ag and Trade Policy up in Minneapolis, and his focus is on the future of food. He's also the senior advisor with the Small Planet Institute, that's Francis Moore LePay, where he's the director of land and food rights, and he is a senior research fellow at Tufts University. So Tim is coming to us from Boston, where their spring weather is probably about as dismal as ours. So welcome back to Iowa. And he also recently did the Shivers Lecture and spoke at ISU. So we did get to meet him in person. And thank you for coming to Iowa. I wish we'd had a bigger audience for your work.
We were there, Donna. We were there.
We showed up. We did. So welcome to the show. And tell us, we've been talking about your work because I regularly read the IATP thing. We've talked to our audience a lot about both your work in Africa, especially discussing the work of the Gates Foundation. You want to start off with that and just tell us the little story about what's in the book and what you found out about AGRA? That's an acronym for something, right?
It is.
Tell us.
It's the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. And it was started by Gates Foundation and Rockefeller Foundation in 2006 with the goal of bringing a green revolution to Africa, one that it had missed when the first green revolution, as it's called, came through most India, other parts of Asia, and some of Latin America, bringing so-called high-yield seeds and fertilizers and
feed the world, right?
And credited with helping feed the world, thanks to your very own Norman Borlaug and his research into improving wheat yields. I got interested in the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa when I was researching my book, which had me in several countries in Southern and Eastern Africa, Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, and Mozambique. And it was a common feature that these inputs of commercial seeds and synthetic fertilizers were being actively promoted. It was also a common
GMO seeds, right?
Non-GMO.
Oh, non-GMO. Okay,
not GMO, because most African countries do not allow GMOs.
Oh, golly gee.
Well, that's, Africa and Europe are the two great continents mm-hmm. that the seed industry would like to open to their GMOs. And they're actively trying to do that in Africa, but they've largely so far been unsuccessful. So
how did the Gates Foundation deal with this situation?
Well, the Gates Foundation is, I think their agenda is fairly clear that they equate innovation with technology. In agriculture, they equate technology with green revolution inputs. And even though those inputs are effectively 40, 50, 60 years old in terms of their when that approach was developed.
Right, it's not new technology. Yeah.
It's not new technology, and it's promoted as the only way Africa can grow enough food. And that's true whether you're promoting hybrid seeds, like hybrid maize seeds, corn seeds, or even if it's not GMOs. So I heard over and over again that these schemes were really not working. They weren't increasing yields very much. Hunger and malnutrition and poverty weren't getting much better. And so I wanted to do a lot more or look more deeply into the larger program, which operates in, at the time, 13 African countries, including the ones that I was researching.
Right. Now,
and point of it.
This program, we have to say, has been going on. Are we at its 20th anniversary or close, right?
No, 15th. Started in 2006.
And a lot of money has come from private foundations. However, our tax dollars are going in through USAID as well, right? A lot of money.
They are. About $1 billion overall has gone into the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, about overwhelmingly from the Gates Foundation. About two-thirds came from Gates, but the USAID, the Agency for International Development, is one of the main partners in the initiative and has been from the beginning. What's striking about the poor performance is that the organization set very ambitious goals initially. They set the goal of doubling yields and incomes for 30 million small-scale farming households.
That sounds lovely.
And cutting food insecurity in half, so cutting hunger in half. So I set out to look at the data and see if they were anywhere near achieving those goals, and they are. Yields have gone up really slowly, barely faster than they were before AGRA came on the scene. Incomes are stagnant, poverty remains endemic, and food insecurity, measured by the number of undernourished people in those countries, has actually gone up 30%, not down 50%, as promised. So kind of a failure on every measure, and a failure on its own terms for AGRA.
Well, can you explain to me? It's kind of like, duh. Okay, 15 years, terrible results, lots of money being spent, lots of money continuing to be spent. How are they justifying this? It's just they have a great PR campaign or what?
That's a good question. I mean, they certainly questioned my research.
As bearer of bad news, right?
Exactly. The bearer of bad news. They started out actually contacting my university, which published the study, Tufts University in just outside Boston, and contacted the research arm to complain that I had not used legitimate research methods and that the university should come down on me. Straight out of the Monsanto playbook of, you know, go after the reputation of the researcher. To its credit, my university actually, in effect, lectured the AGRA on that and said, we're from the Office of Research Integrity, and research integrity means protecting our researchers from the special interests who are threatened by their research. So
you're still standing. Thank you, Tufts University.
Exactly. I do want to say publicly, thank you, Tufts University. But one of the reasons I did the study was that the Gates Foundation, AGRA itself, none of them had published any kind of public evaluation of their progress on those top line goals of increasing yields, improving incomes, and reducing food insecurity. None. No published research.
I wonder why.
Well, you know, it's actually, I mean, that's a good rhetorical question, but it's actually a reasonable question to ask. Why would they not try to document their progress? One answer might be that the progress is poor. I actually have a more perhaps cynical answer to that, which is that I don't think those goals matter to them in the sense that they kind of take it for granted that if you get these Green Revolution inputs into the fields and available to farmers, that yields, incomes, and food security will automatically improve. I've called it a faith-based initiative in that sense, faith in the Green Revolution package. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And it's such an article of faith that they don't even evaluate whether that's true, whether those things are happening. And so this evidence that we presented that it's really not happening, it's not working, I think, is seen as outside noise, you know, that, it, you know, well, of course what we're doing makes sense. If we're not getting the results yet, we just need more time.
Well, do you think that your work has any impact? Like, is Bill Gates reading your book? Are people at the Rockefeller Foundation? Are any of the funders calling you with some concern? What about USAID?
Certainly not. I don't know whether anyone's reading it. I think the research that I did after the book came out on AGRA has gotten a lot of attention. And that's partly because African civil society organizations like the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, which is the largest mm-hmm. civil society network of farmers, food producers, environmentalists, and others in Africa, they took up the research and immediately wrote a letter to all of the donors to AGRA saying, please stop. This confirms what we've seen in the fields. This is not working. This is not where resources should go. And they've gotten very little response. The Gates Foundation never, actually for 6 months, never even acknowledged getting that letter. I mean, it's stunning that they could ignore such an important group.
A little bit another arrogant.
Extremely arrogant. Another group called the Southern Africa Faith Communities Environment Institute, which is a pretty broad-based environmental initiative of multi-faith organizations in Southern Africa sent a letter to Gates, to the Gates Foundation, with 500 signatures from faith leaders in different communities across Africa saying much the same thing. And then they never even got an acknowledgement of the letter, and they still have yet to receive an acknowledgement or a reply, even after all of the
Well, what about the African governments themselves? Where this is, where they're, are they just happy to take the money from AGRA, or what's?
Yeah, the African governments themselves are actually the biggest funders of the Green Revolution, because they pay input subsidies for to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizers. That's the only reason there's any technology adoption at all, really. And they are very much captured by the donors, the Gates Foundation and the other donors, with this Green Revolution program. My fondest hope would be that they would look at our research, look at a donor-funded evaluation that just came out a couple months ago, that was really confirmed almost all of our results in terms of bad outcomes for farmers. And I would really hope that some of those governments would say we could be using our scarce resources in a much more effective way.
Are you seeing any of that, or this is just, at this point, it's still in the discussion phase?
Well, it's in the discussion phase, and I have not seen any of the AGRA-affiliated governments actively challenging the model. That said, what a lot of governments are doing are starting to explore alternatives alongside their continued work on the Green Revolution. And so the government of Senegal, for example, is one of the leaders in a program called Scaling Up Agroecology, which has actually been formally recognized and supported by the UN at the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, funded with pilot studies in Mexico and Senegal and India. And they are very articulate advocates for the benefits of agroecology as an alternative to high input agriculture, such as that promoted by the Green Revolution.
Now, does alternative mean afterthought?
It doesn't actually mean afterthought in some cases. I have to say, the pilot project is often just a showpiece to make it look like you're trying to do something. Mm-hmm. It is also, or it can also be, the beginning of something big. In Mexico, the government changed hands, and a lot of the pilot projects that I've been writing about and studying for 20 years before that are suddenly the basis of government policy, because a different government is in power and different ministers are running their programs directed at small-scale farmers, and they've changed their focus entirely.
Well, so, now, what would cause a government to? I mean, Mexico is we've all been a little bit excited about what's going on in Mexico in terms of challenging, you know, these kinds of assumptions. Why do you think Mexico? I mean, the finances of it. Yeah, they changed government, but explain to me what this is—a radical departure.
It is. Mexico is a democracy, flawed like all of our democracies are flawed. But it leaves open the possibility that a strong social movement that's really dissatisfied with the corruption and pro-business approaches of its dominant parties can opt for something else. And they opted in a big way in 2018, giving a huge mandate the new party of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Morena is the name of the party, and a majority in both houses of Congress, so he could actually make some changes.
Well,
and he has.
The sort of backstory on this is that, of course, Mexico which is the seat of, you know, genetic corn diversity on the globe, has for years been worrying about what GMO seeds are doing to their heritage varieties, of which there are many, 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 many. Talk about, and you put this so well in the book about, just tell us the Mexico story. It's very, brings a little hope for some of us.
It's a very hopeful story. There's a lot in this book, honestly, looking back, you know, it's now been out for 3 years. It means I was doing the research on it since 2014, mm-hmm. really. So many things have that I report on in the book have actually gotten so much better. People have been winning in so many different ways. I followed land grabs, and a lot of resistance by local communities have actually stopped a lot of land grabs. I saw it in my research. I documented
everywhere, or just in Mexico?
No. I'm talking about in
Africa?
All over the world.
Yeah,
I've seen progress. I mean, the Indian farmer protests that we saw over the last year, that lasted for a year and were amazing, were really directly related to the issue that I was covering in the book.
Yes,
which was the farmers, the support prices being paid to farmers. And the
WTO challenge of that you talk about in your book a lot.
So, yeah, the U.S. cynically claiming that India was unfairly subsidizing its farmers.
While, of course, in the U.S. we don't subsidize our farmers at all, right?
No. And so that was a success story. But so too is the resistance to GMOs in Mexico. And so what I covered in Mexico was the civil society organization, the network that filed a court challenge against the government approval of Monsanto, Syngenta, and other seed companies running experimental GM trials in northern Mexico with corn. And they challenged it on the basis of Mexico's store of genetic diversity, like you said, saying that it posed a threat to this these heritage varieties, which are, as you said, Mexico is the center of origin, where the crop was first domesticated, where the greatest variety exists, and where those varieties are grown actively all over the country. So they file this court challenge. They win the initial injunction, and then they've been fighting over the injunction with the companies, and at the time the government appealing those injunctions to stop experimental planting, until finally it got to the Supreme Court of Mexico last year, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the injunction and said that basically, the right to life includes the right to a clean environment. And in Mexico, the right to a clean environment includes the right to protected agricultural biodiversity in a crop as important as corn. Amazing. It was followed by a government decree by the new government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, saying that Mexico would not allow the cultivation of GM corn.
And
so
that they don't
major victory.
They also don't allow GM corn in the human food supply now. Is that going to stand?
That's not quite true, but it's in that same decree. They called for the phase out of the use of glyphosate, Roundup.
That's what they're doing.
The health risk.
Uh-huh.
And they vowed to phase out the importation of genetically modified corn, which mostly now goes into feed corn, but also can get into the human food chain.
Well, we're talking with Timothy Wise here. Lots of good things about our food system. You're listening to KHOR, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That tune is an old-time dance tune, and it's called Speed the Plow. At one time, speeding the plow was something to celebrate, but I think our plow has been sped quite a bit already. That's an old English country dance tune, actually. And our ways of growing things,
our scale of growing things
has created quite a few problems for us. We're talking to Timothy Wise, and he has written a book called Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farms, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Tim, your book is called Eating Tomorrow. It seems like that title could be taken a number of ways. Why did you name it Eating Tomorrow?
No, that's entirely the intent. When I there's a funny story of how I got the title, which was offered up by my colleague Francis Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet and 19 other books. So she's good at coming up with titles for books. And after helping me with over lunch with an early book proposal, I didn't really have a good working title, and we didn't come up with much at lunch. And as I was walking home, my cell phone rang and I answered it, and it was Frankie LePay. And I said, "Hi, Frankie." And she said, "Hey, Tim, what about Eating Tomorrow?" And I literally said, "Well, I could have lunch again tomorrow if you want." And she said, "No, that's not what I mean. Your book, the title of your book." And so it came out of her mouth first, but it's really grown on me because, it, like you said, the double meaning or multiple meanings capture.
Yes, is this an ominous thing, or is it a looking ahead to how we eat tomorrow? It lots of things to talk about.
Well, it's both. And it's like we're not doing such a great job of making sure that everyone can eat today. There's, depending on the estimates, you could say that a third of the people in the world are undernourished or malnourished by unhealthy diets. And eating tomorrow is more daunting given climate change and all kinds of other challenges. But what I'm really referring to here is that the way we produce our food, and we're promoting the production of food in other countries and in other regions like Africa on chemical intensive farms, is quite literally destroying the natural resource base, the seeds, the water, the soil, the climate on which future food production depends. And we are collectively eating our tomorrows, undermining our own future if we choose to continue to produce food that way.
You've been looking at this subject around the world and finding that big ag and big business and big government, it pretty much is enjoying kind of a heyday with making money off of the food that we eat. Donna often says that here in Iowa, as far as food production is concerned, we're here in the belly of the beast, really. And how does all this stuff relate back to Iowa?
Well, I wanted to push Tim on this glyphosate thing a little bit more with the Mexican story, because glyphosate is a very big issue in Iowa that we are not really talking about. We have so much in our, certainly in our soil, definitely probably in the water, and now we're hearing that some of this stuff is in the air that we breathe. It's just everywhere. It's a big invisible issue here. So tell us what's going on in Mexico with the glyphosate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue everywhere in the world at this point. The findings several years ago by the World Health Organization that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen raised the levels of alarm. And that's partly because of the scale of glyphosate use around the world. It's a very effective herbicide, which is partly why it's so widely used. It's also part of the Roundup package. So those Roundup seeds from Monsanto, now Bayer, are, you know, engineered to tolerate large quantities of glyphosate application. So we've seen a huge increase in glyphosate use over the last 20 years, 25 years. In Mexico, the concern is public health.
As it should be everywhere.
And they are heeding the World Health Organization warning. Again, the plan is to phase out the use of glyphosate by 2023. That will involve looking for alternatives. The idea is not, it's to replace them with safer pesticides, safer herbicides, not more dangerous ones. and it's part of a larger campaign in Mexico to promote agroecological farming that uses biopesticides much more regularly than they've been.
And biopesticides are a thing that we could promote more. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, they haven't gotten the kind of research dollars that
I wonder why
glyphosate has. Yeah, exactly.
Well, can you explain for our audience what a biopesticide is, kind of?
Well, it can be all kinds of different things. But I saw it in the fields in southern Africa on a small scale. You know, farmers have a common tree that's grown there is the neem tree, and neem is a very very strong, produces a very strong output that can be mixed into a natural pesticide that doesn't put chemicals in the soil, that repels the kinds of...
We would call it biocompatible or something like that.
That's right. That's right. And, the BT toxin that is incorporated into BT corn that's genetically engineered is actually a natural pesticide that's just being engineered into corn.
Well, it's not natural once it's genetically engineered in there.
Exactly. But it can be used in a safe,
natural
way.
Oh, it's been used
way.
In organic systems for a long time.
Exactly. So those are examples.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in your book, you do talk about, in addition to India, Mexico, and Africa, you bring the story back to Iowa. And particularly I've seen you talk about this. We have our own, you have a wonderful explanatory story. It's not a wonderful story for some people, but you talk well about Matt Liebman's research at Iowa State University and what Matt, do tell us.
Sure. Your readers, your listeners probably have heard this, some of this story before.
Less than you would think.
I came to Iowa because exactly for the reasons you say, that it's the belly of the industrial agriculture beast. And I wanted to understand how did this industrialized agricultural system get started, and how did it turn into the model for the world when it seemed to be serving people in Iowa so badly in terms of the public health, in terms of diets, in terms of jobs, in terms of the environment.
And our wonderful soil, yeah.
Exactly. The environmental track record is not good for this approach to agriculture. And so the first premise of my book is, why are we exporting this to Africa if it's so serving Iowa so badly? And Matt Liebman's work at Iowa State really kind of highlights that it doesn't have to be that way. And that's, I say in the book that everywhere I went, I saw researchers and farmers demonstrating scalable alternatives to this kind of chemical intensive agriculture. They don't look the same in Mozambique as they do in Iowa. But Matt's work on with his Marsden Farm project has really demonstrated what benefits Iowa could see in the Corn Belt generally from extending the rotations used on the on what are now normally rotations of corn and beans, soybeans, to alfalfa, small grains like oats, and to incorporating manure in a, not off of factory farms, but in manure in either in terms of having animals on the farm or animals close to the farm. And the results are astonishing. I was so pleasantly surprised, having read about it and then visiting the farm with him, that, you know, the research has been done now for I think it's 20 years that the farm's been going. And so it's a long-running experiment that will continue with Matt's retirement. He's secured funding to make sure that it's going to continue. And that it's a really valuable project because it shows over time how soils improve under this kind of management with a multiple, an extended rotation, how fertilizer use goes down 90%. Synthetic fertilizer use goes down 90%. Herbicide use goes down 25 to 50%, and runoff and soil erosion are practically eliminated.
I mean, this could solve our Iowa water quality right there. It's interesting because Matt's work is basically, you know, he talks about even if you just do a 3-rotation crop rather than corn soy, you can make it work in more than just financially. Essentially, and I would say this, although Matt might disagree, it's some of what's used in organic practices and has been used worldwide forever. Just a sensible approach. So what did Matt tell you about his win-win work?
Well, I said, when he showed me the farm and quoted to me the statistics, I said, well, that's the win-win-win that everybody's looking for. How many farmers are using it? And he said, almost none. And I was like, why? And he said, well, I couldn't have devised a program that more directly impacted just about every agribusiness in Iowa. And, you know, as soon as I thought about it, it was like, well, of course. It's like, does Monsanto want to see a 25 to 50% reduction in herbicide use? No, that's directly impacting sales. Do the fertilizer manufacturers want to see a 90% reduction in fertilizer use? Of course not. Do the seed manufacturers want to see another rotation in which they don't dominate those seeds? Of course not. Do the factory farms that rely on cheap corn and soy for their feed want to see more expensive corn and soy because you're growing a little bit less of it, so the price will go up? No, they want to see corn and soy as cheap as possible. Does John Deere want to see less land sown to more land put into pasture? Absolutely not. they want to see as much land under cultivation as possible, so people need their machines for everything. It's, you know, as soon as he said it, it was like, oh, of course, but it so contrasts with what the public interest is that I think it really highlights sort of why we all need to look up from those blinders and say, wait a minute, agribusiness doesn't get to determine what the public interest is. The public gets to determine what the public interest is.
Well, we often like to quote Wendell Berry here saying, you know, when he talks about agriculture, the culture has been taken out of the word agriculture and it is now agribusiness. And that is so, so true in Iowa. But you also didn't, not only is it in the public interest to consider these things, most of these things are in the better interest of the farmers as well. why is it that the commercial advertising and the whole system is so not apparently in the best interest of their main customers? What's going on here?
Well, living in Iowa, you'd probably have better answers to that than I would. But the one part of that answer is that agribusiness has come to, and it wasn't always this way, but it has come to dominate farm policy. I always argue that it's really a myth that serves agribusiness to call those who push for farm policy the farm lobby, as if it's farmers who are doing it. It's really the agribusiness mm-hmm. lobby, and they gained dominance over farmers way back in the 70s and 80s, and have since exerted that influence to make sure that policies in Washington and elsewhere ensure the continuation of this system.
You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. To find out more about Donna Lana Kitchen and this fine radio station, go to khoifm.org. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Timothy Wise.
Yeah, so Tim has written a book called Eating Tomorrow, and he talks a lot about international ag trade and policy. So two issues that are certainly front and center is, of course, climate change affecting food production quality and quantity, and of course throw that on top of the Ukrainian situation. What do you think the long term or even the annual effect in this coming year will be of the war in Ukraine? They've already reported that Ukraine will have possibly, I think with luck, even 50% of its normal production, and the Ukraine is the bread basket for Europe. So tell us what you think about these latest news events are going to show up.
Well, I've said that it's hard to know the short-term consequences in detail. It's certainly true that food prices are going to go up. They're going to go up particularly for urban consumers, even in places like Africa, because they import a lot of their food.
And the Middle East.
And lots of other parts of the world that import very large quantities of food. And so those prices will go up. The availability will go down. If you're really dependent on wheat imports, it's going to make you wish you had a more diversified diet and cuisine. Fertilizer prices being so high is, in the short term, a disaster for productivity for those farmers who are dependent on it. I point out that most farmers in Africa are still not using synthetic fertilizers, so they're not on that so-called technology treadmill.
So they lucked out for once,
Yeah, that won't affect them as much, but it certainly affects governments that have promised subsidies for fertilizers, and those are going to get very expensive. They're not going to be able to deliver as much fertilizer, and farmers who are dependent, suddenly pulling back on their fertilizer applications, will see yield declines, so production declines, and that won't help with hunger at all. But in the long run, and or even the medium run, I think a lot of people hope that it's a wake-up call for taking steps to reduce that dependency on just a few crops, and on chemical inputs, particularly fossil fuel-based fertilizer. If ever there were a program that would seem misguided, it's the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa trying to get farmers hooked on, who aren't using synthetic fertilizers now, trying to get them hooked on it. I mean, farmers in Mozambique literally referred to that program as climate stupid agriculture. And they called it climate stupid because it's like, they said, wait a minute, why would we get dependent on an input that we don't produce, that we can't control, that's expensive, and that with the climate crisis is only going to get be less relevant to our future. And they're right. So hopefully governments start to come to that same conclusion, that is not the path to put Africa on. And that's my hope. Already you see actually news of farmers who have been using, dependent on synthetic fertilizers, saying, whoa, wait a minute, those fertilizers aren't even arriving. They're arriving late. They're because of supply chain interruptions, and they're even more expensive than they were before. So maybe I should go organic after all. Maybe I should shift toward low input agriculture. And there's a lot more interest from small scale farmers in making that shift. Again, hopefully the governments will follow suit.
Have you seen in the circles of people that you talk to, and here we are sitting in the middle of Iowa, and I have to ask you this, the high price of fertilizer in Iowa, I hope will mean that we have maybe lighter applications this year. I mean, there are quite a lot of studies proving that we could apply a lot less fertilizer and not lose yield. Are you seeing any evidence of that with the spring plantings or anything?
I don't know. I think the one way that farmers are trying to avoid that problem is by planting more soybeans, right, which you don't need the fertilizer applications for mm-hmm. the soybeans. So you make this a year, you plant more soybeans.
Yeah, plus the Chinese are here. They're saying they want the soybeans this year. Okay.
That's true. And prices are up for soybeans just like they are for corn.
Maybe so, that's why the Chinese fellow was here last week.
could just be. No, but I think the what I have not seen in the United States is any decided move away from this model and its dependence on chemical fertilizers. And I went around when I was in Iowa and we met a few weeks ago mm-hmm. that I was asking a lot of people I talked to, you know, if you got three wishes, what would your first one be to try to shift the dynamic in Iowa's agriculture toward more diversified farming, including bringing animals back on the farm, mm-hmm. and not just that. And the most common answer was federal farm policy and the guaranteed income that comes from signing up with revenue insurance and crop insurance and basically having a guaranteed return if you plant those crops. And it's hard to argue with that. It's very
wait,
hard
do people
to
want to farm. Do away with that, or they want to extend that to other crops?
I think they want to do away with that as a guarantee for those certain crops.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they said it's just very hard to get anyone to take an alternative seriously, because if you're managing risk, which every farmer is,
right,
that eliminates the risk.
Mm-hmm.
If you know you can get a guaranteed revenue stream, whether your crop fails or succeeds, there you go. And I think that's true. The upcoming farm bill will be a real test of whether Democrats in particular are ready to stand up to some of these, some of the agribusiness interests and enact what, antitrust, greater antitrust is needed.
That might be a place where we could get some action. Probably not.
I agree.
I'm not going to be optimistic about the USDA, particularly with the current head of the USDA. But the antitrust thing, hopefully, I mean, the farmers have been asking for this meat packers thing for years, and it was promised, and da-da-da-da-da. So.
Yeah, well, that's one, and I think the other is certainly in, you know, the controversies over extending factory farm, factory farming, are, you know, have reached a level that there may be action on that as well, and that would also help.
Yes, there are a lot of people uncomfortable.
I mean, in Iowa, certainly that and ethanol drive the economy.
Yeah,
feed and ethanol are what you're producing.
Yeah, nothing that us humans are eating except the pork and the eggs.
Well, and then there's high fructose corn syrup that is kind of like one of the food groups now, isn't it, Donna? Oh, goodness. So as we're kind of wrapping up here, Tim, do you have any words of advice to Iowa farmers? Sometimes they just need to hear from somebody besides us. So what would you say to Iowa farmers about, embracing change? It seems like change is in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck when I was there. I was there 2 years earlier, soon after my book came out, and it was right after your bomb cyclone had ravaged the landscape. So April 2020, and the same thing had happened. A bomb cyclone had ravaged Mozambique, with 1,000 dead or more, and an inland lake created 100 miles long. I mean, just a trail of devastation. And I wrote something that said, you know, maybe we're all in the same lifeboat now with climate change. Maybe everyone can realize our common interests. And one of those interests, which the Mozambicans are much clearer about than we are, is the importance of diversity to be resilient to climate change. And I do think that's something that farmers in Iowa can experience for themselves. Certainly Matt Liebman's research documents it. So I think that's diversity is a path forward. In diversity, there is strength.
Risk reduction through diversity. Yes.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you for being with us. We've been talking to Timothy Wise and about his book, Eating Tomorrow. A good book. So thank you, Timothy, and thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Donna Lana Kitchen. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band, and we heard the tune Speed the Plow. Support KHOI. This is a community radio station, and your support helps keep us in your ears. Support your local food system, too. We're all in this together. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisguntas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.